Hello and welcome to Happy Place, the show that gets to know the authentic you. I'm Fern Cotton and today I'm chatting to an old mate of mine. It's Jordan Stevens.
If you were to look at particular goals or achievements in your life as games, if you were to approach it as a game, then at least you'll know when that game's complete. And then you know that you're setting another game. I've had a total complex about Rizzle Kicks because there was a point where I was so wanting to be this idea of myself that I'd created that I'd almost forgotten completely what I had achieved. And then I have to just accept the reality that I achieved all my goals. I completed the music game in a year. We had a platinum album, that's all I ever wanted. But I'd never let myself just go, well done, you've completed that game.
Jordan shot to fame as one half of Rizzle Kicks in 2011. But overnight success isn't always what it's cracked up to be, as Jordan discovered when he started turning to drugs to quieten an anxious, noisy mind. What Jordan's experiences have given him is real compassion for understanding why people engage in hedonism and substance abuse. He's incredibly self-aware about the work he had to do and continues to do to make sure he's living as healthy a life as possible, both physically and mentally. One of the biggest shifts seems to have been in how he measures and acknowledges success. He used to be constantly chasing after a missing piece that might just make him a whole person. For you, it might be the house, the job, the partner, whatever it is. But he's learned to recognise that there's freedom in letting go of that constant cycle. So profound a realisation was this for Jordan. He's written a children's book called The Missing Piece. Although I have to say, I think there's a hell of a lot we can take away as adults too.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, here is the show. We've got so much to catch up on.
Oh, no.
I don't know where to start.
I don't know either. I suppose I don't know either. Yes.
Well, where we could start is right at the beginning where I met you, which was really fortuitous and strange and not how people would expect.
Are we gonna do? Oh, so we're gonna lay the ground?
Why not?
With the yeah.
Why not? So I know your godfather.
Yes,
Ray,
very well.
Who is the most wonderful man, and he's one of the people in life that I don't see enough. And I text saying, oh, we should have a coffee, and then it never happens. I feel really shit about that.
Don't.
I love Ray.
Don't. He's fine.
He's fine. He's lovely. So he's your godfather. I'm like, he's a photographer. I was working with him one time, and he said, you are going to love my godson's music. And I was thinking, oh, God.
Yeah.
I don't want to listen to this. What if it's awful? What do I do? And I watched the video of you in Rizzle Kicks and was like, who the hell are these two? They're amazing. This is so fun. This is what we need at the moment. And then I think literally a week later, I was playing it on the radio.
Yeah, mad. It was one of those, what's it called, serendipity?
Yeah.
Serendipity or synchronicity? Because we had, fortunately, we had everything. We had all the artillery ready for that moment. But it was fortunate, you know. But I want to credit myself and Harley for, we did have this kind of year. We didn't go to uni. We decided to have our gap year as a grind gap year. We were just going for it. And we rung everybody we knew in London to do with music. Do you know what I mean? I would play it to them. Ray was more in touch than that, of course. So when he heard I was doing music, he was really into it. But yeah, we had managed to do enough promoing and website development, and we'd made this music video with my friend Toby. So when you heard it, we were ready, because you said, I think it was one of your producers who got in touch, and we actually had, fortunately, that just established the infrastructure to be able to act on it, which was amazing. And because of that, I mean, our life changed because you did that. You put us as record of the week. Maybe it was the month then. No, week. It was a week.
Yeah, a week, yeah.
And then, and it was, I remember it so clearly. You know, we were in the charts at that point at 144. That was what we were doing with all of our little groundwork, you know, because that's probably quite a good result, actually.
Amazing result.
Yeah, yeah. And then it was July 2011, and the end of that month, we were number 8, I remember. And that was it.
Wow.
Captain Cotton.
Yeah, but do you know what? I was very lucky at that point in my career that I had any sway on anything. Yeah. And I'm only ever a tiny part of that, like you say, that whole journey. But it's a beautiful thing. I loved being able to do that. That was the best part. That was the job for me, going, oh my God, this person's amazing, this band are brilliant, whatever. But if the song's crap and it doesn't resonate, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. Do you know what I mean? It has to connect with people and what you were doing and that sort of fun and levity that you brought.
Yeah.
Just people just loved it. It was infectious and it carried you onto this like amazing, ever-changing career journey that you're still on. I'm still on. Yeah. It's ever undulating and moving and changing. And you've done so much since then. I mean, more recently, you've done some sublime acting, which...
Right. Little bits.
Yeah, but some amazing things. Star Wars and like some very, very cool parts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, the acting thing was an actual mistake, which is cool. I think that will maybe infuriate all actors listening.
Who cares?
Because it's the worst... I am someone who feels obliged to express themselves in kind of any medium. That's... I've got to this point, you know, kind of 10 years in where I have to just accept the fact that I like doing loads of different things. I envy those who can focus on one thing, but then I speak to people who focus on one thing and they talk about
one thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, so I try my hand at anything, but of all the industries I've been in or worked in at all, I'd say acting is the most savage.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, I'd say the acting world is pretty horrendous, actually.
In terms of self-esteem, or...?
I think, just to explain the accident side of it, I began acting because me and Harley got a meet. Harley, by the way, is an incredible actor. Mm. He's taken his time, but when he's going to be, I'm very confident about it. Even if it's something I write, like he writes, he's very talented. But he's been battling with anxiety, but I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point. But we both got meetings because we had done well and we were in the public eye, so we got these kind of meetings. Do you want to do any work in acting? I actually said no. I said to my agent, I don't want to act. I would love to write and direct one day. Harley's the actor, you know. But because I was so mouthy in interviews, I got given this wild card audition for a show called Glue, written by Jack Thorne, who's now one of the greatest British screenwriters there is. He wrote the Harry Potter play. He wrote, he's collaborated with Shane Meadows on his last TV thing. I can't remember what it's called now. Amazing actor. Oh, I can't, I've gone blank.
Who's the? It's the Heat.
Who's the?
You can't
who,
think straight.
Who's the? No, who's the? He's another amazing actor. He's Scouse.
Stephen Graham.
That's
love
it.
Him.
He wrote on Skins, This Is England. Anyway, his Dark Materials. I'm obsessed. Yeah. I love him. But yeah, so I read the script and thought it'd be rude for me not to audition. And I just happened to be the character. I need to explain this. I just happened to be, at that time, a fucking mess. The character was a fucking mess. And it just synced up. I didn't know how to audition. I didn't know how to do anything. I turned up to audition and tried to get naked because that was in the script. And the guy was like, please, please keep your clothes on. But they were like, he's fantastic. Do you know what I mean? Because that would have been... something different. I turned up late.
It's always the way. When you go really wanting something and trying too hard,
it never works out. And that's what I mean about it being savage with acting. Actors will clarify this. Mm. These people can sense desperation. It's unattractive.
Yes. Yeah. I had that experience once, yonks ago. This is when I was in my early 20s. And I was doing probably Top of the Pops or something at the time. And ITV were like, oh, we really want you to audition for Love Island, which was a very different concept to the one that is on the telly today. It was like celebrities and whatever. Yeah, it was in Fiji. And I was like, oh, I don't know if it's very me. So I went. I think I'd had 2 hours sleep. I was hungover / maybe still even a bit drunk, to be fair.
Right.
And I was just a bit like whatever in the meeting. Like, yeah. They're like, what do you think you could offer it? I was like... I was just sort of whatever. Yeah. And I got the
nonchalant
job.
Yeah.
But then since then, after that, I was like...
professional.
Yes, I was wearing my best outfit. I'd slept for 12 hours. Yeah. Didn't get a bloody sausage. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It's mental. I know. It doesn't make any sense. And it still continues. It's an energy thing. It's an intention field thing. But
isn't that interesting? Because it's even the same with dynamics with partners, friends, that when you have someone who's so eager and overbearing, you're like, oh, no. But when someone's a little bit, not even standoffish or cool, but just their energy is more contained, you're like, oh, my God, I'm quite curious about this person.
Yeah,
who are they?
You're drawn to it.
I'm not very good at doing that.
I know. I think the sweet spot is preparation and then surrender.
Letting go.
It probably takes years to master.
Yeah.
But I think, like, it would be stupid to be, because I had a phase where I think I consciously tried to underprepare. That also doesn't work.
Acting like you're underprepared.
So to carry on that, basically, I got grilled in an audition for Glue. I got like five recalls, which isn't normal. So
wow.
I was chemistry tested a lot, because it wasn't like, let's shove this little pop star into the show. It was like, can this pop star act? And I got the part, which was crazy. And then since then, I feel like I've just been falling forwards. I lived with one of the main actors in the show. He ended up living with me after we did Glue, and I saw his kind of thing with acting, and I kind of accepted that there's a whole other level. He's called Billy Howell. He's an incredible actor and will be huge. But it's just, you know, the way he was, I don't know, engaging with it. It's lethal, because as an actor, you're constantly employed and unemployed.
Yeah.
There's no control. There's no reactivity. So for me, with music or writing or books or whatever it is, if I feel a pushback, I actually have it within my power to do something about it.
Yeah.
In acting, if you get to the last two, three, or don't get anything or whatever else, and you don't get it, you have to wait. Mm. I hate that. That's why actors go, listen, actors can be some of the wildest people you'll ever meet in your life, because they got all this off time. And that's also why I think actors end up with actors. But
yeah, I there's bits of my career that I think mimicked that, where I was solely TV presenting, and every January I'd shit myself because there'd be nothing in my diary for 12 months,
right.
And I would just have to wait. Hence why I now don't do any of that, and I've tried to create something where there's more control. And I feel like, you know, we're very similar in the fact that we're probably not very good at sitting back and waiting. So, you know, that having a creative endeavour is really key to staying feeling good.
Yeah.
And you've branched off into all these areas, not content with just doing the music thing or just waiting around for acting jobs and auditions. You're doing solo music now, you know I've loved,
because
I've
so
listened
cool.
to a ton of it,
I loved
and it's brilliant.
That.
But also now this gorgeous book that lies on my desk here,
it's
The
mad.
Missing Piece, which is so beautiful. And I texted you the other day because I read it to my kids the other night, and you were like, what? You're reading it to your kids? I didn't know that this was going to happen. And it's like, this is what's going to happen now. Loads of families will read
it. No, I think you actually might be the first parent ever to read that book to their children. That's wild, isn't it? Because that wasn't even planned.
That's so
I didn't even think about that. I didn't think you'd do that.
Of course. You have to test it out on these little blighters.
I mean,
they loved it. And it's got a beautiful... We're going to get onto all of this. It's got a beautiful undercurrent that adults can pick up on and take heed of, because usually the messages that you want your kids to understand are the ones that we still really struggle with as adults, because we probably weren't taught it, or it's just still the culture we live in is quite toxic in a lot of ways and stops us from really understanding what's what. And the message in this book, we'll get onto the deeper level in a minute, but for a kid, being very much, it's not in the end result, the thing, getting the thing. It's all the spontaneous happiness and what happens along the way. And I chat with my son about this all the time, who's obsessed with Pokemon cards. And he'll go to me every morning, can I buy some Pokemon cards?
Pokemon
and I'm like,
cards, are they still...
They're still going.
Mate, that is an incredible industry, that.
You tell me about
it. To be fair, my little brother does. I've got a little half-brother. He is obsessed.
The amount of money we've spent on Pokemon cards. And I keep saying to him, look, if you get a pack and there's nothing in it, you're just going to be disappointed for the rest of the day. But if you get a pack and it's got a great card in it, you're going to feel good for about 10 minutes. And then in an hour, you're going to go, can I get another pack?
Pure pain, yeah.
And it's just this cycle. And he's like, what are you talking about? I just want a shiny VMAX. Stop giving me this.
Sorry, I know you're going in a path on this, but just as a side note, there's a Pokemon card store in Holloway, where you can get the kids to pick the shiny out.
I'm never going there.
No, because then they pick it. And it's only like a fiver.
Yeah, but then he's going to go, can we go there every day? Like, my son will just now think that that's how you get Pokemon cards. You go and you spend extortionate amounts of money on the shiny card he wants.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm trying to teach these moral lessons through the medium of Pokemon cards. It's going badly.
But they are designed beautifully.
They are designed beautifully.
There's some really... When I took my little brother to that store, I was like, God damn, these artists are really quite abstract, actually.
This is what Rex said. Rex said, Mum, look at the artistry. Look at these characters. He's trying to get me hooked into it. But it is... It's an essential piece of messaging that I don't think... And it's not just for kids, because we're all doing it to an extent.
Mate.
We're all looking for... You know, whether it's the promotion, the perfect partner, the holiday, the pair of shoes, and we still have this strange mythical conclusion that that's going to make us then feel happy forever or complete or better than we did beforehand. But it's ephemeral. It comes and it goes, and it's then we need it again. And it's, I mean, how are you doing with that one?
With a desire for more and more and more. Yeah, I'd say I'm insatiable, yeah.
It's the human condition, sadly.
Yeah, I think the idea of enough, I mean, I understand it, you know, I understand it in theory, in philosophy, that I heard a great quote the other day, which is that freedom is the absence of want, which I like, because it's difficult to put a finger on freedom sometimes, you know.
Yep.
And maybe that still isn't it, but I like the sound of it. Yeah, I think, you know, I've got an addictive personality. I am an addict. I think that's what people say. I'm an addict in that I have that capability to become obsessive with things and definitely love a dopamine rush. But I do think that there are steps I've taken in my life that have lessened the impact or lessened the desire for the constant need of dopamine, actually from removing some of the dopamine, which is an interesting one. But... Yeah, man, I definitely in terms of my career and who I am as a person, you know, the kind of more egoic desires, for sure, man. I'm always thinking about, like, it's not enough, I've got to do this and that. I did listen to one thing recently, a game theory. I'm not sure if it's called game theory, but an outlook on life, looking at it specifically as a game, right? Which really helped me, because the person was basically saying, I'm going to paraphrase here and I'm not doing it justice, but he says, this guy who's a probably a very qualified philosopher. He said that if you were to look at particular goals or achievements in your life as games, if you were to approach it as a game, then at least you'll know when that game's complete. And then you know that you're setting another game, right? And that resonated with me because, for example, I've had a total complex about Rizzlekicks because I've been around this entertainment industry now for a decade and I've started to see the ups and downs and the curves and people come and go and people, you know, go into this crescendo and all this kind of stuff. And there was a point where I was so wanting to be this idea of myself that I'd created that I'd almost forgotten completely what I had achieved, you know? And I think it was difficult with Rizzlekicks because it's not normal for it to go that quickly. Like, you put it as record of the week and it went. And then we were there for 4 years, decided to take a step back. I've seen people's trajectories last a lot longer. They've gone through a lot more rejection, a lot more fighting, a lot more, you know, and then they finally get this. Little Sim is a great example. Finally, 10 years of hard work for Simbi, and then she's like, you know, popped off. But with us, it was like, first go. It was like, what? Do you know what I mean? So I had this idea in my head of like, does everything just happen like that?
Yeah.
And then I had to tell myself recently, this is like within this year or maybe even last year, like, I have to just accept the reality that I achieved all my goals. I completed the music game in my mind in a year. We had a platinum album. That's all I ever wanted was a platinum album. But I'd never let myself just go, well done, you've completed that game.
Yeah.
Now everything else is a bonus, or maybe there's a new game, you know? And I think that feeling really did help calm that desperation for, and I used it as well with sobriety, actually. I used to say that without, before I even heard this game theory, I used to say that almost as a joke. I heard it from a friend. People would be like, oh, you don't drink anymore. I'm like, yeah, I completed drinking.
But it's so, do you know what, it's so interesting when you look at that model in terms of success. What you've just described there is the perfect example of how all of this goes against the grain of what we're taught in society. So we're told, you know, you could look to social media, to TV, to newspapers, to whatever infrastructure is going around in our culture. And the myth being that when you have success, you feel complete, you are fine, you are happy forever. And you've just described this sensational success that happened in, let's say, 12 months.
Yeah.
But you didn't go, now I am happy forever. Yeah. I'm going to sit back and chill, which we're all hoping happens, but it doesn't. Never. And we all kind of know that. And we can hear millions of stories about CEOs at the top of their game who are completely in bits and mentally a complete mess, or pop stars or movie stars or whoever it is at the top of their game. And they still have all the issues from the past, the lacking they felt before they were successful. Nothing changes about who you are as a person. It's just how other people treat you. That's the bit that changes, because they imagine that you're something different, that you are so untouchable or whatever. And it's like, oh no, I've still got all the same bag of shit that I'm carrying around and stuff going on. And nobody really wants to hear that, because we all hope, first of all, that when we reach this pinnacle, we will feel different. But also, it gives us all almost an excuse to go, well, it's all right that I feel so terrible, or that I'm angry, or that I'm pissed off, because I haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
But when I do, or you can look at other people and go, well, it's all right for them because they've reached that point and I haven't. So I can be in suffering. But it's, if we just dismantle the whole thing, it's like terrifying.
Yeah.
Terrifying. So when you reached that, and I heard a bit about this on your TED Talk, which I only stumbled across recently, and I absolutely loved it. You completely nailed it. It was brilliant. I learned a lot about you that I didn't know. Oh. But when you reached that pinnacle of everything that you desired as a musician, as a teenager growing up, wanting to get a platinum album, when you reached that pinnacle and looked around and went, I am, like you say in the TED Talk, I'm one of the top dogs now. I'm like, I'm up there with the big players. I'm mixing with everybody else who's done very well. And you had that realization that you didn't feel complete. You didn't feel this ultimate everlasting happiness. What then?
Well, literally, I ended up making some pretty awful music. I remember after with Rizzo. No, we had the second album. We had the second album that did well, but then that's it. So I suppose we had a different, the expectations rose around
us. Always the next level.
Yeah. And I suppose the goalposts moved and our desires became bigger and larger. And then all the pushbacks became more painful. And I think, you know, a couple of decisions, I think there was slightly different creative decisions. I mean, you hear this a lot with music, the slightly different creative directions and desires between myself and Harley and perhaps the label. We never meant to be pop stars. We only wanted to make music, and we love making music. And then we found that there was a new idea of us that was outside of our control, and people were talking about this idea. And we felt as though, you know, we, and also, by the way, we were like fucking 20 years old. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, so these like freakouts. Now I look at 20-year-olds now, I'm thinking, fuck me, I was that age.
Yeah.
Of course I was freaking out. So I was wanting to be, you know, all the things, you know, taken seriously or respected, all this kind of stuff, on the basis that even though we were in this pop market, we were making the hip hop we grew up loving, you know? But, you know, the more commercial songs were the ones that are played and da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, so we're in this whirlwind of opinion and critique and also success. And so that was hard. But we were ultimately just trying to make music, man. We're trying to make music. We're trying to balance making music we loved and being current and whatever the fuck you have to worry about. And actually, the shift came from... I was a little bit worried about myself, and then Harley began to, his issues began to come up too. I can't really speak, I mean, that's for him to talk about, I'd love for him to speak with you about this actually, but it was just to do with anxiety, generalized anxiety. We took a year off to regroup. I made some other music. I made this music with a group called Wildhood, a band I formed, which is like the antithesis of Rizzlekick. So I just wanted that outlet. And Harley made some incredible solo music as Jimmy Charles Moody, which just honestly blows my mind. And then we came back together, and it just didn't feel like running back into the pop world was the best idea. And it was at the, this is a more of a kind of a like nerdy maybe like outlook on it, but it was at the transition into streaming. So we were watching labels have absolutely no idea how to deal with streaming. Yeah. So we were like, we're just going to let this, you know, this one, so we take a step back. And then we just grew up. That was it. I feel like I started to grow up at 26. I remember thinking that. And loads of things hadn't processed. I hadn't processed where I'd been. I hadn't processed the gigs we'd done.
It's all too quick.
It was, So I just did a lot of that. And then, you know, focused on trying to grow up. And then I was confronted with the next stage of life, which is, you know, interpersonal relationships and becoming a mature person. which is something that definitely the entertainment industry fame in itself can definitely delay. You live in a kind of suspended state of existence.
It's such a cliche, but it's absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, it took me decades to not be a teenager. Yeah. Like, decades.
How old were you when you started
15.
Presenting? 15. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Serious?
Yeah. And working like every week in that environment with adults and commentary, and it took me years, probably in my 30s, where I started to go, wait a minute, I still am mentally 15 here. I need to look at everything and change everything. And, you know, that's where everything imploded and I changed the whole thing. But I think it is a cliche, but it's a very, very true one, sadly, because it's such a strange environment to find yourself in.
Yeah.
And during this TED Talk, again, as I said, I learned so much about your life and your experiences. And we've been texting a bit over the last couple of years because we have an amazing mutual friend, Donna Lancaster, who I've probably mentioned on this podcast like at least once a month, because she's sort of a mentor to me in life. I know she has that kind of role with you as well, where you can speak to her as a great friend and a wise, wise person in your life. And I love her. She's got a beautiful book out called The Bridge.
Yes.
And she helps so many people out there find some equilibrium and peace and all that good stuff that we want. So we've spoken a bit about this, but there was a missing piece without realizing it was a pun for your book. But there was a missing piece, like watching your TED Talk. I had no idea that you'd had addiction issues, that there was drug use. I didn't know about any of this. So where in the timeline?
It was very high functioning.
Did that fit in?
So it was almost cliche. So when I was saying I was a bit worried about myself after the second album, that's what I was talking about. So I remember getting into cocaine like just after, I can't remember when it was. There was a point where I'm not sure about the specifics, but there was a point where I had finished, I think we'd finished the second album or something like that. And there was this gap. I remember this gap between finishing it and it being released. And, you know, the type of mind I have, I wouldn't be able to listen to it without wanting to change something. The idea of not being able to change it was hard for me, especially now with this newfound expectation. The first album was like,
everything's a plus.
Second one, I'm like, oh my God. And there was this gap in time, and I just remember just having like time, money, and, you know, attention, which is a savage combo for like a 20-year-old boy who also was a weirdo. I was an odd teenager. I wasn't like this kind of like, I wasn't like a jock or whatever the UK equivalent. You know what I mean? What is it? What is it?
What is an English jock?
There isn't one. But people know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But there wasn't. Like I just about got through on the basis I was a good footballer. You know what I mean? So I was in some popular circles, but I was odd, man, for real. Like I used to... Yeah, I didn't even understand friendship, for example.
We saw the Cisco video on the TED Talk where you're recreating a Cisco dance routine.
That was as a kid.
I'm
talking teenager. Okay. Yeah, teenager, I was still that kid. But I mean, the reason I say that is that there's some kind of dangerous power dynamics at play there. Because if I feel like I have not had a certain power growing up, or if I was, you know, then the fact that I suddenly have it, I don't know what to do with it. And you see that especially with men, it can become, or boys rather, that can become dangerous, you know, having that power, because suddenly I'm just like, right, well, I'm going to go out every night and, you know, try and pick up someone and whatever else and get into these kind of cycles of kind of just hedonism, pure untapped hedonism.
What, wanting to annihilate all your thoughts and numb, like what was the what were you chasing, what were you wanting out of that?
I definitely think I can't remember when I did this TED Talk. It feels so long ago. I must have been like 2015 or something. I can't remember when I did that, so I'm just trying to place where I was in terms of my kind of journey with drugs. But it was definitely, I had a noisy brain, and the issue I had with coke or just with an upper, the whole thing with amphetamines is that it's actually how the people medicate ADHD.
Yeah.
So this is just my personal journey. So interestingly, my actual abuse, my drug abuse and drug addiction didn't actually stem from me wanting to just go out all the time. It actually stemmed from me staying in. Because it was the only time I'd ever felt the voices in my head kind of quiet and become simplify. Mm. Not necessarily the greatest thoughts that I was left with, but you know, they were kind of very, I don't know, trashy, but they were still less thoughts than I had.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's what drove me towards it. And also, this is another one, I don't think I've ever said this before, I can't remember if I've said this on the podcast. I was fucking anxious, man. This is what I remember too. It was a complete mindfuck being in front of the people I was in front of, people I'd grown up watching on television, like people who, and I was so, I remember, this has just come back to me now, actually, I can feel this in my whole body, but I remember being terrified of saying goodbye to people, right? There's a weird obsession. So I would like go into a room and I'd see someone I'd seen on telly. I don't know who it would be. It could be a footballer, it could be like Jimmy Carr or someone like that, right? And then it would talk, oh yeah, no, I've seen you, you know, we're just new kids on the block, da, 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 da. And I'd be like, all right, cool. Well, I'll see you later, man. And then I don't know what I'd do. Handshake, fist bump, I don't know, a hug. And I would think about the way I said bye to everybody in that room for, oh my God, for like an excruciatingly long time. And when I did drugs, I didn't think about that. When I did drugs, I just went into the room and was like, hey, what's good? And then fucking carried on with my night. Do you know what I mean? Really simple shit. And that's why I can understand why people get into this. I can understand why that scene exists. I can understand the people you meet there is all just this hedonistic. And I missed it for years. When I stopped, I missed that world because it just is this irresponsible escape, you know? But I ended up finding some form of medication for ADHD a few years later, just before the TED Talk, I think. And I think that took me off drug abuse, I'd say, because really it was like I say it was just at home I was writing loads.
Did you have an understanding that you had ADHD before you started taking drugs?
I had been diagnosed once, but I didn't really believe it. I didn't like take it very seriously. I got put in a special education unit at school for my GCSEs, so I was allowed to stand up during my GCSEs. That was it. And then I was later re-diagnosed as an adult. And in the middle, I went to New York and took a friend of mine's ADHD medication called Adderall, which, right? And I did it almost as a laugh. And then I remember taking this Adderall, and we were in New York, and a bunch of friends were having a bit of fun at that time. It was a really great place to go for me and Harley because it was really peak attention for us here. In New York, no one knew who we were. And then I suddenly had this calm come over me with this Adderall. And I could think, I was about 22, 23 when this happened. I could think about what I was going to say. Fern, I'm not lying to you, right? Before that point with Adderall, I honestly didn't know people could think about what they said. I thought when people weren't saying anything, they just had nothing to say. I didn't know that they were considering it. So I had, honestly, I at that point used to just say, what, I mean, you would have remembered that of me, I'm sure. I used to come around your house and I was blah, 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 blah. Like, because you had those Christmas parties, whatever.
Oh, those Christmas parties. And I was telling Anushka, the producer, about these parties earlier. Bloody hell.
No, but I would honestly motor mouth, and then I'd think about what I'd go about, wait, going, fuck, what did I say? You know? And anyway, so I realised that, you know, there was another part of the world, which was that your thoughts have another space to go to before you say them.
Yeah.
So that was part of the journey, and then eventually I was again diagnosed in Harley Street by a guy who looked at me and said you quite clearly have ADHD. And I'd also been self-medicating on this stuff, and I'd been taking way too much of it. It's just another story.
It's so interesting. I've been learning so much about ADHD. I actually did a King's College course to learn more about it recently.
Really?
Just wanting to really get to grips, because I've had loads of friends diagnosed recently. I know a lot of kids who have got it, and I'm really desperate to understand more about it and the different presentations. I don't even know if I've got it or if Jessie's got it. You know, all these.
Well, they reckon you can develop it now.
Yeah, I think, but also our demographic went undiagnosed as kids in all areas. It just wasn't, this stuff wasn't talked about. That's why I think there are so many late diagnoses now.
Yeah, of course.
Because people are going, oh, right, that makes sense as to why I do this, why I do that, and whatever. And I think it's so interesting because clearly you've now found a medication that really suits you, which is,
well, yeah,
or not.
Which is,
no, the one, are you on medication now?
No.
No, you're not. No, okay.
I've come off that as well.
You've come
now
off it. Yeah. But this is the interesting thing, because this is what I was learning about on this course, is there isn't obviously one route to take as a kid or an adult. You've got to find what works for you, and it could be a lifestyle thing, it could be therapy, it could be just having that awareness, changing something in your life, or medication. It's got to be, and it goes for all, you know, neurodiversity or mental health problems, that there isn't one answer. You've got to take this medication. You've got to do this. You've got to find.
You have to find, yeah.
What works for you.
Definitely. I wouldn't suggest going the route I went necessarily in terms of like accidentally medicating yourself with the worst drug, by the way.
Yeah.
I just think cocaine is just the worst drug. But but everyone in London, anyway, it's just it's a wild underground.
Yes.
Is it even underground?
Probably
is
not.
It underground?
Probably not. Probably not. I just don't go out, so I don't know anymore.
Yeah.
But I remember
you,
back
of course
in the
you
day.
Fucking remember. What, music in the 90s? Are you serious?
Horrendous.
Jesus Christ, they're doing it on their desk at record labels and that.
Quite literally. Yeah. Like, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It is. But you know, but I do, again, mass compassion for why that happens, why people engage in that world. And yeah, like I say, it was based around an insecurity, I suppose. And it's just a constant crutch. And again, the difficulty for me was I was also very high functioning. Like I said, it got to a point where I was high on television and shit, you know, but no one would ever know until I've told them on a massive podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So, and now we can look back and spot those episodes.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It's so interesting because I think, you know, whether people listening to this now have ADHD or not, so many people are going to relate to that social anxiety and how that individually manifests. So for you, it's this very cute thing of like saying goodbye to people. I still have terrible social anxiety in lots of situations, but I'm very good at masking it because for my job, I can see it and articulate and think about things and be interested in other people's stories, etc. But I still walk away. Like, I went to a wedding Thursday, and as I was going to bed, my head was like, why did you say that?
Yeah,
what did you do that for? Why did you? They probably thought you were really awkward. They're probably looking at you thinking you're a dickhead. Like, I don't know how to eradicate that. And I'm feeling it even while I'm in the situation. I'll still say things without thinking it through properly and go, why? Why did I just say that?
Yeah.
Because I'm anxious, I'm nervous, I don't know how I'm being received by other people.
It's wild.
And I think it's got worse. Certainly over the pandemic it got worse because we all went into our little holes and hid for ages, and I really went into a little hole and was like, oh God, this is quite cozy, wonderful.
Yeah.
And I'm still coming out of it, and I find that, especially in the strange industry that we work in, have worked in, where it's so heightened, where you might be in a room with someone that you really admire, or you're with people that are very big characters that seem confident. They might not be, but they're presenting themselves in a way where they're the ringleader of the room, courting everybody there and creating some noise. And I just feel like I want to hide.
Yeah.
I don't know how to deal with that. I think probably more people feel like that than not, I would say.
100%. And also with ADHD, I think generally from the stuff, because I'll check into certain podcasts and stuff like that. I love listening to, actually at the moment, really love listening to like really long form podcasts. I'm listening to like 2-3 hour ones. It's crazy. But ADHD, I think, is becoming more prevalent in society just because of the way society is structured, because of our screen time, our usage, and because of the encouraging of unhealthy behavior. So, you know, I definitely think people are, or if they have some kind of dormant ADHD, or if they are dealt with ADHD, it's definitely being like, you know, heightened. You know, it's being...
How we live today it's not sustainable, and we all know that, in terms of like how much we're on our phone, but also how we are seeking distraction. We didn't, you know, if we were doing that back in the day, it was probably in quite a harmless way. We were just like, I don't know, watching crap TV, or we'd buy a magazine or whatever. But now you can do, like, watch TV, read a magazine, and be on TikTok.
Yeah,
and you're like, your brain's going like a ping pong going around a machine, like, wow, what's going on here? And we're all caught in that cycle, and we don't actively seek to counterbalance it that often. Do you have techniques now where you know it will help you to get your brain thinking in a simpler way, or to have that space away from all the craziness?
I think one thing that helps me with my ADHD now, I don't medicate. I find food nutrition is really helpful for me, nutrition and exercise. So I usually am more erratic if I've eaten something non-beneficial for my body.
Yeah.
And exercise, you know, if I'm in a routine, I've just been through a phase, I've just been away, but before that, almost a month solid, 2 months solid of this half an hour training with my friend on Zoom every single day. And I just feel so strong and you know, they're natural endorphins, natural feelings of goodness and happiness. And I feel I make better decisions when I'm in that space. But food, listen, food is a whole thing. Food is... It stresses me out beyond belief in the world, just because one of my compulsive behaviors that I battle with nowadays is body dysmorphia, actually, which I got a few years ago because of an unfortunate, that's another story. But the point is I have a dysmorphic idea of what my body's like. Even if I'm in really good shape, I feel like, you know, you see it when people go to the gym. It's a real thing. I think it's actually a really silently common issue for men. Women too, but
yeah.
But
I think most women have it, sadly, but yeah, men don't talk about it.
That's what I was about to say, yeah. I haven't heard as much discussion about it from a male perspective.
No, I haven't.
But I think it happens. I think it happens in a weird, extreme way. But I can only talk on behalf of myself. And yeah, it's just like I'll feel sad sometimes when I don't feel as though I'm in as good a shape as I could be. Something I'm working on. I speak to my girlfriend about it. But the thing that upsets me kind of externally about it is, sure, I have my own responsibility on being kinder to myself. But I also feel like I'm constantly fighting a world that's encouraging not only my body, but everyone else who I love's bodies to have shit things in it.
Yeah,
and like this got totally heightened by me learning about nutrition and being like, fucking hell, this is awful. Like, this is, once I understand what our body needs to be fueled, that we'd actually need to even eat that much, but when what we do eat needs, has to be like this and that, and it seems common sense just to fuel your body with, but then there's encouragement of these really addictive sugars and really addictive fats, and them together is like the best thing in the world. And
yeah,
that, it freaks me out. I get, that's like the most severe form of existential dread. And all the stuff in our language, all the colloquialisms and the societal, the accepted ways of engaging with each other about food encourages that. It's you see the way people talk about those people who want to eat healthily. You know,
yeah, like, people give me shit about it all the time.
It's like, come on.
Some twigs and seeds. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, just, well, also, I've got a really dark history of eating disorders. So I need, I have to be like this.
Yeah.
I'm not going back there. Do you know what I mean? But
right.
It is very, you're totally right. People are like, oh, just have a burger and shut up, like chill out or whatever. And it's like, I want to feel good. I want to have energy. I want to be healthy. I don't want to be like I used to be back in the day. I want to feel good about myself. And I think it's the same with drinking. You know, if I go out and say, I'm by no means sober, but I rarely drink. I'll probably have, like, I went to a wedding last week. I had one glass of champagne. I was absolutely hammered from that. I was like, I need to go home. But if you say, oh, I don't really fancy, I'm not drinking tonight. People are like, what?
Yeah.
Chill out. Like, have a drink. And that's a very British cultural
thing
as well, that we get shit for not drinking.
Massively. It frustrates me. It feels like it's all part of a greater plan to keep everybody trapped in this space.
And, yeah.
Yeah, because...
Well,
yeah.
I mean, so if you have to...
I feel like I diverted then. Sorry, I kind
of
went into
this... No, you're going
this,
off on great little tangents.
I went into this haze of...
That's what this is about.
Yeah.
But say you find yourself, due to the work you're doing, whether it's book writing, music, whatever you're talking about, promoting, or you're at an event, there's people that you know there, whatever. Do you still have that surge of social anxiety, or do you know how to deal with that now?
I think I'm getting better now. I think in comparison to where I was, oh my God, hugely. Because I think as I've got older and as I have gone through more and as I have given my body, like, for example, recently I cut out coffee. For me, which
I don't know if I
know. No. Listen, I have everyone around me adores
my
it.
Only sin.
And I envy. No, it's not a sin. What? Listen,
drink quite a lot of it.
Well, look, whatever. For me, I could not avoid what was clearly happening, which was that I'd start off, I'd have 3 months of bliss.
Yeah.
One coffee in the morning, great. Push it to two, great.
Yeah.
Then it starts getting a bit later, 3 p.m. Or like, you know, I feel crazy if I hadn't had the coffee for me because I have the addict in me. Right.
Drinks it all day.
Yeah. But then in the evening, the thoughts were wild.
And
it's like, I can't keep doing this. So, for example, now I don't have that. I drink decaf. I love decaf. Obsessed. I'll drink 1,000 cups of decaf. Like, oh, it's only. But if I go to these events, I'll have the thoughts, but I'll be within myself to be like, okay, I'm just going to let those pass. I have to give myself credit here. I've definitely got better at that. I don't fear those events so much because I don't think I need anything from them, you know? I'll go there and the only thing I feel sometimes at these events is I feel like a bit of a misfit. I go to events where there's like a cliquey crowd or a crowd that I think are really cool or something like that.
I can't deal with cliquey cliques.
Yeah. But individually, they're all probably great. But yeah. It just in me, it creates this bizarre chasm between us. And I remember just being in like the playground or whatever. That's the only thing that I think lingers. And then I begin to kind of overthink people's. But then even then, I'll just take a moment and be like, everybody is just a fallible, you know, complex chaos thing.
Most people in that room are feeling that.
Yeah.
We're all feeling it, but we all assume everyone else feels really comfortable and like they belong there.
I want everyone to, you know, there'll be that egoic part of me that wants everybody to know that I'm amazing. Oh, you know what I mean? I want everyone to be like, oh, he's so amazing. Like, talk about coolness. What about this guy? This guy's the coolest, you know? And then I'll say this shit to my girlfriend. She'll be like, what the fuck, you are cool. I'll be like, no, but I need this. I need these people to say that. I mean, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
I was thinking about this last night, and I don't know if it's because somebody said to me, are you watching Love Island? And I was like, I haven't seen it. I've got nothing against the show. I haven't watched it. My only big, big fear with that is that when these people come out of the show and then they've already got like millions of Instagram followers and whatever, their hope is that they're liked. Yeah. And we all have this.
Yeah.
And if they're not liked, then it's like, what do? They don't know how to cope because they're now really famous, but people don't like them or whatever. But we're all feeling this on social media, but actually we have forever throughout history in our lives. We want to be liked. And I was thinking, why is that? Like, it's obvious, it's nice to be liked, but what is the deep down historic, like the prehistoric feeling of I want to be liked? You know, is it tribal? We want to be part of a gang so we feel safe and we feel connected. Like, what is that? Like, I think for a lot of us, our fear is driven from we're just so terrified that people aren't going to like us and that, you know, when you leave my house today that you might think, oh, didn't like that, don't like that, or whatever. Like, that's our worst fear, that we're disliked. It's a powerful thing.
I think for me it's just a battle of self-worth, isn't it? Because to worry about being liked for me means that I've placed my value in an external opinion. So I feel I least care when the value is sat with me. So if I go into a space and I'm like, no, I know where I'm at, what I've done. Literally, I know this is true for me because I can measure it. So if I've sat down and written like 2 pages of a book and I love it and I'm buzzing and I'm imagining, you know, I'm living in my own imagination about where all these things will go, and I go into a room and I'm confident about the fact that I will be going back to that book at some point, and that's something it's a purpose, just a purpose, you know, a goal, all these things that the soul needs. I'm not going to be too fucked about what person thinks I'm da-da-da-da. In that environment, in that moment, if I have just, you know, not got a job or something I thought was going to go well or whatever kind of valuation, and then I go into a room, I suddenly need something from that room. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think in a world where we are... I really feel like there's so many things in this world that actively try to deconstruct us. Well, of course they do. It breaks us down. Consumerism is built on inadequacy. You know, these corporations or these big brands, they need a person to feel like they need them in order to feel better.
Yeah.
You need to have this person's name on your chest. Otherwise, you've got no social currency, or you need this otherwise. You know what I'm saying? Like, get this quickly before you go on holiday. Otherwise, you'll look, you know what I mean? Or it's all based around us not feeling secure. Mm. So I can understand why we all end up that, because we get hammered with it when we're young. And
yeah.
And also, yeah, and then you say, and then it's just a normal thing of like, well, it is just really lovely when that comes. But, you know, then there are ancient spiritual practices, which is, you know, you are to treat critique as you are to treat compliments. Mm-hmm. You're not even supposed to get taken away by compliments, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, which it's is all wild. A neutrality that yeah. we have to just sit with and go, it is what it is. Like, yeah. some people are going to like us, some people aren't going to like us. Sometimes we're going to be accepted, sometimes we're not. It's just life, isn't it? But we're all desperate. And, you know, going back to your book, because I know that there's obviously, that's the message, but this alludes to that addiction in a sense. Yeah. It doesn't have to be drug addiction, but it's the addiction for more, for the end result, for the big shiny bit that, you know, kids get in small hits, Pokemon cards, toys, the TV show, YouTube, whatever it is. But we're worse than, you know, we're doing it. Adults are doing it all day, massively. Every day, looking for the next, when will I be okay? Who's going to fix me? And it's, and I know that from when we've spoken on text, you've got obviously an inherent understanding of that, but you don't know how to replace the word journey, so I'm going to use the word journey. But your journey has been about getting that without the stuff, without the things, without the exterior.
Yeah,
it's
proper.
An inside job. And it's not like, yay, Jordan's done that one tick. Like, that's not a game. That one's a lifelong. You just got to keep going back to it.
Yeah, the game theory in that respect is a hard one, isn't it? Where does that game end? I suppose setting achievable, reasonable goals, you know, that you can have little games in the big game. You know what I mean? You can have little achievements. But yeah, I think I definitely want to be in a place of self-validation for sure. That's the kind of goal. I have friends who have this ability to be able to just create, love what they create, put it out. And I love that. I love that energy. I just think as I'm getting older, more responsibilities come in. I have to start making more rational decisions. And then I sit and observe the consequences of those decisions and then pivot and figure out if in this situation, maybe I actually need less of something or I don't need any more, you know. But I'm learning the whole time because also life's changing so rapidly.
Yeah.
And I think I'm fascinated by people. I really am fascinated by the world and people. I think that helps me. I want to have a strong idea of self and also a detached idea of self. That's the dream, you know? And it comes in waves. Often when I've eaten well for a week.
And had some sleep.
Yo.
And had your
the
decaf
five tent
coffee.
Poles.
Yeah.
Has Donna been on here?
She is coming on in September.
So in her book, I'm sure, I haven't read all of it yet. I started reading it last week.
It's amazing.
She will mention the five tent poles. Of whatever, and I've said this before on podcasts because it's just everyone needs it, and it's oh, maybe I'll let Donna say it actually.
You can say it. Can
I
tee up Donna?
Okay.
For September.
Well, it's just that it's just a lot of the time in life when we do feel a little off center, one of the tent poles is off, and that's fine. And then you can just know that there are other reasons. It's not just your thoughts or people's ideas or whatever else. There's other reasons. So sleep, nutrition, exercise, creativity, solitude / community, you know, walks in nature, six tempos. Fuck the six. Walks in
See,
nature.
My sleep and solitude tempos have gone awry. They're bent. They've been like smashed by a hammer. I need those ones back in.
Yes.
I've had no solitude.
I'm fucking awful on sleep.
I need solitude.
Parents' life is, I mean, there just needs to be some other tempos for parent life.
There really does. You have to find mental solitude in the craziness and the chaos, I think. Where's your self-compassion at? Not only for you today, because I think this is the thing that we all need to work on constantly, is self-compassion, acceptance, whatever you want to call it. But how's your self-compassion for when you were making, as you've called them, bad choices, whether it's drugs or partying or looking for outside validation? How's your compassion for that version of yourself?
Oh, you know what? I don't know. I feel like it's dead. I feel like it's a different version of me. I feel like that person's died.
But can you feel at least
grieved?
Sort of,
grieved, perhaps. But maybe I've grieved. I do think you're. I think you're right. Actually, I think that's something I haven't confronted. I haven't gone back there and maybe hugged that part of myself or understand. I understand why. You know what? I definitely understand why.
Yeah.
I made those decisions and was in that world totally. I totally get it. Yeah. But I feel quite Like, especially in lockdown, I went in a whole other way in terms of I really wanted to make myself strong, man, and self-sufficient. And, like, I just came out of lockdown, like, ready. It was this other energy that I don't think I'd focused on in myself. I don't know what to call it. I don't know whether I'm going to put a masculine or feminine energy on it. I don't know whether that's right. I haven't thought about it. But there's definitely a fierce energy that came out where I was like, okay, here are my boundaries, you know, and I'm kind of no fucking, you know. And sometimes I had to accept, I had to be hard, like, not hard on myself, but I think I had to go, that's not me anymore.
Yeah.
And I had to let it go. Because I definitely have a tendency of holding on to things. We have such a weird world now, man. Like, in my phone, I've got my phone. I've got, this is another weird fact about me. I have, I don't know how to get rid of it, but I've got like some like 65,000 photos on my phone.
I think I've got more.
No way.
Yeah, it terrifies me. I don't know.
I can't get rid of
them. I'm a technophobe. I don't know how to put them anywhere else. No, I can't. What to do.
I'm not a technophobe.
Do I put them on a...
You have to change your entire... No, you have to change your entire iCloud.
I'm too scared.
Yeah. No, same.
I don't know. All of it terrifies me. I don't want to lose them, but I also need them not on my phone.
Right. Me too. This is it.
Stuff like that stresses me, so I pretend it's not happening.
This goes back to, my phone goes back to about 2012.
Wow.
2013.
So I think mine does. Yeah. I think I've got pictures of when Rex was born on there.
Mad shit. So I'll get sometimes on my phone, it'll go like, here's a memory.
Oh, like, from 1964.
It'll be like 2014. And I'll be like, holy shit. And then I'll sit with it. But then I do just let it go.
Yeah.
It just feels different.
That's good, because I've talked to Donna about this a lot, and it's still something that I want to... I've just got more healing to be done on the me in a certain era of my life. And, you know, I've done everything that everyone else has done. I've been mean to people I shouldn't have. I've done silly things that I regret, and I hold on to them too tightly. And
really?
Need to, like, forgive
you don't
myself.
Forgive yourself for it?
No, I've still got a lot of work to do.
Okay.
But then there are, like, darker bits of my life where I'm like... I do need to hug that version of myself.
Really?
But even going back to bits of it is like, I can't, I'm not there, I'm not ready. I can do it a bit here and there, but it's not like I haven't found the peace bit yet.
Does Donna say that you should go back and hug that version?
Yeah, we talk about it a lot, and we're going to do some more sort of ceremonial work some cool stuff together where we really get stuck in. But yeah, it's all self-compassion based stuff.
Do you think the fear of confronting that version of you contributes to some of the ways you act now?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I had terrible sleep last night. I get really bad night anxiety.
Right.
I've had quite a good patch of sleeping, but last night, every worry that could ever be created was in my head. And I was just like, oh, I am absolutely fucked. And I've got a really long day today and the kids are off school already. And it was just like, blah. And it is, I know that if I go back to certain eras and I've got to make peace, I'm already waiting for that tidal wave of self-loathing first that I've got to work through.
Oh, man.
I'm so aware of all this, and I've done so much therapy, but there's still stuff to be done. And I'm quite accepting of that. And I'm quite accepting that it might take years or forever. And I'm kind of fine with it, because I've always got something to talk about. I've got books to write. I've got things to get stuck into. Well, to work with all that shit.
Okay.
And get it out.
How are you with anger?
I'm quite reactive, which is, again, something I need to...
No, I don't think so. I mean, rage isn't good.
No, it's never rage, but I can get pretty angry.
Anger was, for me, that was actually a real way out of stuff for me.
Really? What, to have a cathartic release to get it out?
I think my therapist and I feel, and I believe her, it makes sense. A lot of my self-destructive, self-abusive behaviours was inverted anger.
Hmm.
Anger that could have been expressed healthily. Healthy anger is, like I say, boundaries.
Is that anger towards other people exclusively, or sometimes towards yourself?
I think the anger towards the other person it could have been anger towards yourself, because you have allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So in a dream world, you know, we have our boundaries and we value them, that's it. So if we were to honour our boundaries, then we're in that...
Oh, I think I've got a lot more anger than I thought.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm not fucking qualified for that at all. I just whenever I speak to my friends or, you know, because obviously I've been through the bridge of Donner, I did a retreat just a couple of weekends ago, actually, with a group of men, which was great,
amazing.
Called A Band of Brothers, which was amazing. But it speak to people, and it's one of the worst aspects of this type of Western society in Britain is this kind of staunch, you know, one mustn't express one's, you know, and then you get the other extreme, which is the kind of rah,
yeah,
you know, but there's not this middle bit, which is like, just say, I mean, Donna would say it's saying ouch, you know, it's just going no,
yeah,
ah, like that, because we think we overthink it, or we shouldn't, maybe it's rude, or you know, or you're putting ourselves second because that's what we learned as a child.
Yeah,
it's really hard to do it, but if you can do it, I think you are rewarded by a sense. You're telling yourself, "Oh, you value your this space." Really hard, by the way.
I'm getting much better at that one. I felt a shift, even only like a few weeks ago. I just felt something shifting. Like, what is this? Like, I couldn't put my finger on it. I was like, "Do I cut all my hair off? What is this? Like, what is this thing? There's something happening. There's something that's going on." And I had a couple of really good little tests from the universe of like, this, minor things, nothing that's going to, like, rock my world. And I could feel myself going into the habitual thing of self-loathing. I've done something wrong. I wasn't aware.
Oh, God, I've done something wrong.
And then I thought, no, actually, no.
Good.
No, this is your shit.
Wrong thing is the worst. The wrong thing is the worst.
I hate that. Oh. That's my default in everything is my biggest fear and my go-to is I've done something wrong, but I didn't even realise.
Yeah,
it's that extra bit of I didn't know I
like
got
a
it
guilt
wrong.
Thing.
I didn't know I had it wrong. I thought I was doing the right thing, and you're telling me I got it wrong.
I empathise
that
with that
is below
so much.
That runs below my life always.
Fear of wrong.
Yeah, but this me not getting it. Like, I'm so stupid that I didn't even know that was wrong. Like, that's... I go back to it. But last week I thought, no, I'm not going back to that.
It's got to be a fucking anger there, man. You know what? This is so deep because that is one of my main triggers is I have a fear that I'll be wrong and because I'm wrong, someone will leave.
Yeah.
Honestly, so bad that I had it the other day with, like, one of my closest friends. And it was... I was battling between my objective rationale and the deep wound that it was. So we had a debate. It was a heated debate. He believed something, I believed something. But because he so believed that I wasn't right, because he believed I was wrong, I started to think, fuck, what if this is, what if? Because I've got been wrong in his eyes, he's never going to speak to me again. And then I'm sat there on the sofa going, what? I was actually upset. I couldn't believe I was thinking that. Of course he's not. This is someone I love. You know what I mean? Wild. So it's deep set. And I had the responsibility that day to try and do what I could. And actually, hilariously, because I have no vices anymore. I don't even smoke cigarettes anymore, really. I just ended up eating loads of cake, to be honest. But
a good option.
I was aware, at least. It wasn't ideal.
You knew why you were doing it.
It wasn't ideal. Yeah, it wasn't ideal.
But it's the awareness. You think, I know I do that. I certainly will comfort eat and go, I know why I'm doing this.
I would not say, I don't think people should comfort eat. But it was just, it was almost my number one. Like, I was really.
Yeah.
So, and then outside of it, then I kick into what I've got to do, which is, you know, protein, good food, running. Oh my God, running.
Running.
But I think the anger thing, man, I think it's just like going back and just fucking destroying these things for you, in your imagination, destroying the things that have made you feel that way. Like, you're allowed to be, I'm saying this as if I'm not qualified, but I feel like you're allowed to just have a space. My therapist and I form these spaces where I can just be fucking ever and just get it done.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Get it out.
And then...
Yeah, sometimes I will do that when I'm running. I'll be like... I will be Usain Bolt around the park because I am
getting it out
of my system. I want it out of my body, but I need to almost do that every day.
Yeah,
like,
it's hard.
Because there's probably years and years of shit that I need to just get out of. But it's so interesting that thing about believing you've got it wrong, because I don't even think I've got a fear of the other person leaving the scenario.
Yeah. No, that's definitely specifically me. That's you,
but I think it manifests in different ways. My fear is I'm just a shitty person.
You're just shit, yeah.
I'm just a shitty person. And I don't deserve anything that I have, and other people.
Oh, like imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Oh, hugely. Like that.
Have you spoken to your therapist? Is this a Is that mean you've been working on?
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
I feel because like it goes back to I'm a shitty person, I haven't done enough to help, I haven't done enough, whatever it might be. I'm a shitty person. Like, it just ends.
So wild.
That is where it ends. And now I'm in my 40s, that's where I want to go, this needs to be deleted, this sentence, because it's just boring. It's been boring to go back to that all the time. You know, what am I aiming for? To be like a saint, a perfect, like we're humans.
Yeah,
we
wild.
Fuck up, we do things wrong, we can be a shitty person and we can be a beautiful person. It's we just can be
like,
all of it.
It must be, for me anyway, I feel like it must be a thing where we or I or you are so used to, it's just a comfortable space. It's like
it's easier.
Yeah, and that other place, because if we were to use my trigger being the abandonment thing, the discomfort in that place is going, well, you know, I've said what I said. That literally is that energy. I said what I said.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's the space where, because I always want to find union. And as I get older, what I really want to get to is a place where it's like, this is what I believe, and I'm happy to open for other ideas. But in this moment, this is what I, you know what I mean? Just standing by it.
Yeah.
And not being nice. I've been nice a long time. That's the thing I was trying to get out in this retreat the other day, was to get rid of this fucking nice thing. I like being kind to people, but sometimes people need to fuck off.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? Sometimes, and I need to be cooler. That's the uncomfortable space. I'm going to stand in the fact that you need to fuck off, and then we can talk about this another time.
It's a boundary.
Yeah. But that's, you got to live in that for a bit so it becomes comfortable. It's the same as anything. Yeah. It's like freaking out when you get in water. It's like water being cold until it's not. You know? Wim Hof, man. Has he been on here?
We love him.
You know?
But it is, none of us want to sit in discomfort because it's not nice. It's that simple. But it's the place of growth. It's the place of
pain,
learning.
Pain, pleasure, balance, man.
It is. And it's the place of, like, it is. It's balance, isn't it? It's the equilibrium of going, you know, there's good and bad and light and dark and whatever it is. It's all coexisting and we have to see it all and
also
sit
I bet that fucking feeling of, like, actually getting something wrong and just accepting it is bliss. I did get that wrong. Anyway.
Yeah, I did that last week. I actually apologised to someone, but very neutrally. I didn't feel, like, self-loathing. I'm really sorry that that's how you feel and that I've contributed to that and I'm very, very sorry. And I left that peacefully.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah.
Saying sorry is a good one. It's a real good one. Jordan, I could talk to you for about 5 hours longer because we could just even hone in on anger for like another hour and just go on that.
I want to say though about the missing
piece. Yeah, go on.
That I have actually written the book for adults. That's the kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I've done a deal with Bloomsbury, which is amazing. I came to them with this idea. I had this idea for about 6 years because I just had an idea. I was interrogating my own obsession with completing things.
Yeah.
Right. And just more and more and more and more and more. And it was only when I was reading my friend's kid a book called The Fox and the Star. So
I love that book.
Right, yeah. So shout out that author because it is straight up inspired me to write a kid's book. Don't know if they'll listen, but it'd be cool if they did. And then I read it and was like, what the fuck? This is deep. So I was like, maybe that idea I had in my head I can make into a kid's book. So that's it. I put a tweet out. You know, someone put me in touch with this wonderful woman called Julia Churchill, shout out, who was unbelievably patient with me. 3 years for me to do one redraft. I met up with her, told her the idea. She's like, this is great. In Waterstones in Piccadilly. She's like, this is a great idea. Write it down, send it to me. Wrote it down. And she was like, it's not quite what you had said. You know, just have a think about it. And then over the course of 3 years, I changed the lead character to a dinosaur. I wrote a different kid's book. She's going, no, but just what you said to me on that time, you know, checked in on me every 6 months. And then 3 years later, I'd got writer's block.
Horrendous.
And I went, well, if I've got writer's block, I might as well look at the things I've already written. Open up this kid's book, and then I've seen that I've added this bizarre storyline. The original one I gave to her, I'd added this kind of like, I'd made the grandma into like a detective. Anyway, it's really weird. So I just was like, well, I'll delete that then. So I just deleted it. And she's like, okay, great. That was it. 3 years. I just deleted half of it. And then she sent it round. Bloomsbury meet up with me, and Bloomsbury, out of all the kids' books were amazing, but they were like, look, we think you can write more. So I've got a deal to write 3 kids' books with them, and I've written the second one. I've got the outline of the third one. But my goal, my kind of, I don't know what it is, manifesto, is that the books, I want them to be engaging for kids. I want them to love the colours, like Beth Susanna, incredible illustrator in this book.
Beautiful.
The colours are unreal. And I had to pick from a lot. It was a crazy situation to deal with all these different people's versions of Sunny, this character that I'd lived in my mind. But Beth, there's something about the colour she used. But the story, man, it's like, you know.
It's for adults.
Yeah. Because I want people to have that feeling I had when I read The Fox and the Star, or where it's like.
No, I got it straight away. Really, my kids were like, as you say, engaged in the pictures, there's repetition and the colour. And but I was like, I get the sentiment.
Do you know what I mean?
I get the sentiment.
Especially with the missing piece. This is a fucking ancient sentiment. This is we've heard this all throughout our life, but it's giving that lesson, that journey through the lens of a young girl. And then also just adding a little sprinkle of eldership, which I really wanted to add, the theme of how important, I wouldn't say, because not everyone is lucky enough to have grandparents, or they might not be grandmothers or whatever, but definitely having another tier. Yeah. I think that's so important with child. I
mean, intergenerational, even friendships are so important. Yeah. Like I've got three really good mates, all in their 70s.
Yeah,
and that
wow.
is a different conversation, that is a different mindset, wisdom. Like, we need all of that. It's really important.
Yeah.
Really important.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. Well done. It's amazing. I love it. And it's so exciting that you're putting all of your thoughts and creativity into another beautiful thing.
Yeah. Thank you for reading it to your kids. That's super exciting.
Oh, well, they loved it and I loved it. And it's been so good talking to you today. So thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, Fern.
Listen, when I said I could have chatted to Jordan for more hours, I meant it. He did actually end up hanging around at mine for quite some time that day because there was so much to talk about, and we've continued that conversation on the phone, which I'm sure will just continue till the end of time. Thank you so much to wonderful Jordan. His book, The Missing Piece, is out on the 18th of August, and you absolutely must read it to every child that you know. Now, we're going to be taking a very short summer break from the podcast, but we'll be back in September with loads of brilliant new episodes for you. So make sure you're following the podcast so you get a notification as soon as we're back. In the meantime, I'm hoping that I'm going to see lots of you at Tatton Park, our next Happy Place Festival. We're going to have the best time. Massive thank you again to Jordan, to the producer Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you. I love you, you brilliant humans, and I'll speak to you very, very soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.